he hoped. Unfortunately, that meant his ordeal here would last a minimum of 9 months. He didn't know if he could stand it. Suspecting face dancers everywhere, he started growing a child from the mysterious cells salvaged from a dead Tliloxu master's damaged null entropy capsule. Meanwhile, on a daily basis, the Matre Superior made her impatience known for her supply of melange substitute. She was jealous of every second he diverted his attention from her needs. Panicked and exhausted, Uxtal was forced to satisfy both obligations, even though he had no experience at doing either. As soon as the unidentified Gola baby was implanted in the first functional axolotl tank, Uxtal turned his efforts toward making the spice alternative. Since the Horrors already knew how to create the substance, Uxtal required no breakthroughs or flashes of genius. He simply needed to manufacture the chemical in great quantities. The honored Matres couldn't be bothered to do it for themselves. Gazing through a one-way security window into the gray sky, Uxtal felt as if the landscape of his soul was like the charred, lifeless hills he saw in the distance. He didn't want to be here. Someday he would think of a way out of this. Born to an insular religious circle, Uxtal was deeply uncomfortable around dominant women. Among the Tliloxu race, females were raised and then converted into brainless wombs as soon as they reached reproductive maturity. That was their only purpose. Honored Matres were the polar opposite of what Uxtal considered right and proper. No one knew the origin of the Horrors, but their propensity for violence seemed to have been bred into them. He wondered if some foolish renegade Tliloxu master had actually bred the honored Matres to hunt down the Bene Gesserits, much as Futars were supposedly bred to hunt down honored Matres. What if the newly grown female monsters had gotten out of control, and the result was the destruction of all sacred worlds, the enslavement of a handful of lost Tliloxu, everything gone wrong? Now, trying to look like a commanding administrator, Uxtal paced through the laboratory and watched two white-smocked lab assistants tend the special Gola tank. A new modular building had just been brought in on a lift suspensor mechanism. The new laboratory wing was 3 times the size of the original facility and required tearing down the neighboring slig farmer's fences and appropriating a portion of his land. Uxtal had expected him to object and thus incur the wrath of the honored Matres, but he had seen the fellow. Was his name Gaxhar? Meekly move his sligs to another section of land. The women also demanded that the farmer provide them with a constant supply of fresh slig meat, which he did. Uxtal took a quiet pleasure in seeing someone so downtrodden, in knowing that he was not the only one helpless in Bandalong. In the older laboratory, captured women were chemically lobotomized and converted into breeding vats. From separate operations in the new wing, Uxtal heard the muted screams of women being tortured because pain. Technically, the adrenaline, endorphins, and other chemicals the body produced in response to pain was a primary ingredient in the special spice the honored Matres craved. Matre Superior Helica had already gone to the new chambers to oversee the niceties. Our facility will be ready as soon as I have properly christened it. She wore a tight-fitting gold and silver leotard that revealed the generous curves of her body, along with a matching cape and a jeweled headdress that looked like a crown mounted on her blonde hair. He didn't particularly want to know what that meant. Each time he saw the Matre Superior, Uxtal struggled not to reveal his loathing, though she must recognize it on his grayish face. For his own survival, he tried to show just the right amount of fear in her presence, but not too much. He did not grovel. At least, he didn't think so. After a particularly loud volley of screams came from the new wing, Helica swept through a doorway and into the laboratory section where the impregnated axolotl tank lay on its chromed table. She enjoyed looking at the single mound of sweating, odorous flesh. The Matre Superior nudged Uxtal roughly enough to knock him off balance, as if he were her comrade in arms. Such an interesting way to treat the human body, don't you think? Only suitable for women who were worthy of nothing else. Uxtal had not asked where the donor women came from. It was none of his business, and he didn't want to know. He suspected the whores had captured several of their hated Bene Gesserit rivals out on other planets. Now that would have been interesting to see. As bloated axolotl tanks, at least these women had gone to their proper place, to be receptacles for offspring. The ideal of a Tlaloc Sioux female. Helica scowled upon seeing both laboratory assistants tending the one pregnant tank. Is that project more important than mine? We are in need of our drug. Do not delay. Both assistants froze. Bowing before her, Uxtal said immediately, Of course not, Matre Superior. We await your pleasure. My pleasure? What would you know of my pleasure? She loomed over the little man, regarding him with her predatory gaze. I wonder if you have the stomach for this work. All the original masters are dead as punishment for their past crimes. Do not make me add you to that number. Crimes? Uxtal didn't know what the original Tliloxu had done to the honored Matres to earn a hatred strong enough to warrant complete extinction. I only know genetics, Matre Superior, not politics. He quickly bowed and scuttled out of her reach. I am perfectly happy to serve you. Her pale eyebrows arched. Your lot in life is to serve. When the past returns to us with all its glory and pain, we don't know whether to embrace it or to flee. Duncan, Idaho, More Than a Mentat. The two axolotl tanks in the no-ships medical center had once been Bene Gesserit females. Volunteers. Now all that remained of the women were gross mounds of flesh, their arms and legs flabby, their minds completely vacated. They were living wombs, biological factories for the creation of spice. Teg could not look at them without feeling bleak. The air in the med center smelled of disinfectants, medicinal chemicals, and bitter cinnamon. The Acolyte's manual said, "A defined need leads to a solution." In the first year of their odyssey, the Tliloxu master had revealed how to manufacture melange with axolotl tanks. Knowing what was at stake, two of the refugee women had offered themselves. The Bene Gesserit always did what was necessary, even to this extent. Years ago on Chapter House, Mother Superior Odraid had permitted the creation of axolotl tanks for the Sisterhood's own Gola experiments. Volunteers were found, females who could serve the Order in no better way. 14 years ago, his own reborn body had emerged from one of them. The Bene Gesserit know how to demand sacrifices of us. Somehow they make us want to do it. Teg had defeated many enemies, using his tactical genius to achieve victory after victory for the Sisterhood. His death on Arrakis had been the ultimate sacrifice. Teg continued to look at the axolotl tanks, at these women. These sisters had also given their lives, but in a different way. And now, Thanks to Cytale and his hidden null entropy capsule, Shiana needed more tanks. When studying the contents of the null entropy capsule, the Sook doctors had also discovered face dancer cells, which immediately cast suspicion upon the Tliloxu master. The frantic Cytale insisted that the process was controllable, that they could identify and select only those individuals they wished to resurrect as Golas. With his life beginning to ebb, the little master had lost all of his bargaining power. In a moment of vulnerability, he explained how to separate face dancer cells from the others. Then, once again, he begged to be allowed to grow a Gola of himself before it was too late. Now, Shiana paced the floor beside him in the medical center. Shoulders stiff and neck arched, she looked over at Cytale. The Tliloxu master was not yet comfortable with his new freedom. He seemed nervous inside the med center, as if smothering in guilt because he had revealed so much. He had surrendered everything, and now he no longer had any control. 3 more tanks would be best, Cytale said, as if discussing the weather. Otherwise, creating the group of desired Golas will take too long, 1 at a time, each with 9 months of gestation. I am confident we will find willing volunteers. Shiana's voice was cold. When you finally begin this program, my own Gola must be first. Cytale looked from one pale-skinned axolotl tank to the other like a doctor inspecting test tubes in a lab. My need is greatest. No, Shiana said. We must first verify that what you claim is true, that these cells are indeed samples of who you say they are. Scowling, the diminutive man looked at Teg as if to find support from a person who claimed to worship honor and loyalty. You know the genetics have been verified. Your own libraries and chromosome sequencers have had months to compare and catalog the cellular material I gave you. Simply sifting through all those cells and choosing the first candidates is quite a task. Shiana sounded pragmatic. All of the identified cells had been separated into secure storage drawers in the genetic library, code locked and placed under guard so that no one could tamper with them. Your people were extremely ambitious in the cells they stole, dating all the way back to the Butlerian Jihad. We acquired them. My people may not have had a breeding program such as yours, but we did know to watch the Atreides line. We understood that great events were about to unfold, that your long-standing search for a superhuman Kwisatz Haderach was likely to reach fruition around the time of Muad'Dib. So how did you get all the cells? Teg asked. For millennia, Tliloxu workers have been handlers of the dead. Though many consider that an unclean and despised profession, we did have unprecedented access. Unless a body is completely destroyed, it is simple enough to acquire a skin scraping or two. At 14, Teg was still gangly and on his way to becoming a tall man. His voice cracked at embarrassing moments, though the thoughts and memories in his head belonged to an old man. He spoke just loudly enough for Shiana to hear, I would like to meet Paul Muad'Dib and his mother, the Lady Jessica. That is just the beginning of what I offer, Cytale said, aiming his glare at Shiana. And you did agree to my terms, Reverend Mother. You will have your Gola. But I am not inclined to hurry. The elfin man bit his lower lip with tiny, sharp teeth. There is a ticking clock. I must have time to create a Cytale Gola and raise it so that I can trigger his memories. Shiana gave a dismissive wave. You said yourself that you had at least a decade left, possibly 15 years. You will have the best medical care. Our Bene Gesserit doctors will keep watch over your condition. The rabbi is a retired souk doctor if you don't want females tending you. In the meantime, we will test the new cells you offer us. That is why you'll need 3 more axolotl tanks. The conversion process will take some months, then the implantation of the embryo, then gestation. We will need to perform many tests. The sooner we produce enough golas to allay your suspicions, the sooner you will see the truth of what I have told you. And the sooner you can have your own gola, Teg added. He stared intently at the 2 axolotl tanks until he could picture the women they had been before the hideous conversion process. Real females with hearts and minds. They'd had lives and dreams and people who cared about them. Yet as soon as the sisterhood had declared its need, they'd offered themselves without hesitation. Teg knew that Shiana had only to ask for more. New volunteers would consider it an honor to give birth to heroes from the legendary days of Dune. We are the wellspring of human survival. Mother Commander Mirbella. Mirbella's scouts returned ashen-faced from a flyby of the intact coordinates found in the scuttled Honored Matre ship. Racing out to a distant star system far beyond the known limits of the scattering, they discovered evidence of great carnage. When Mirbella received the recordings from the scouts, she watched them in her private chamber along with Belanda, Doria, and the old archives mother, Acadia. "Utterly wiped out," said the scout. Young and intense, she was a former Honored Matre named Korea. Even with all their military might and violence, she couldn't seem to believe what she was saying or what she had seen. Kyria installed the Shigawire spool into a viewer and projected holograms in the middle of the room. "See for yourselves." The unidentified planet, now a charred tomb, was obviously a former Honored Matre population center, with the remnants of dozens of large cities laid out in their characteristic fashion. The inhabitants were all dead, buildings blackened, entire metropolitan sections turned to glassy craters, structures melted, spaceports cracked, and the atmosphere turned into a dark stew of soot and poisonous vapors. "This is worse. Look." Deeply disturbed, Korea switched to images that showed a battlefield in space. Strewn through the orbital zone floated the wreckage of thousands of large, heavily armored ships. Bristling with weapons, these were the Honored Matre's great vessels. All of them destroyed, littering space in a wide ring. "We scanned the wreckage, Mother Commander. All of the craft were of a similar design to the Honored Matre battleship we encountered here. We found no other types of ships. Unbelievable." "What is the significance of that?" Belanda said. Kyria snapped at her. "It means that the Honored Matres were annihilated. Thousands of their best battleships, and they didn't manage to take out a single one of the enemy. Not a one." She brought a fist down on the table. "Unless the enemy removed their own damaged warships to keep their workings secret," Acadia said, though the explanation did not seem likely. "You discovered no clues about the nature of the enemy? Or of the Honored Matres themselves?" Mirbella had already searched through other memory, striving to delve into her Honored Matre past, but had encountered only mysteries and dead ends. She could trace back along the Bene Gesserit lines, following life upon life all the way back to old Earth. But in the Honored Matre line, she found almost nothing at all. I gathered enough evidence to be frightened, Korea said. This is clearly a force we cannot defeat. If that many honored Matres were wiped out, what hope does the new sisterhood have? There is always hope, old Acadia said unconvincingly, as if quoting a platitude. And now there is incentive as well as a dire warning, Mirbella said. She looked at all of her advisors. I will call a gathering immediately. Almost 1,000 sisters had been invited from all over the planet, and the receiving hall had to be substantially modified for the event. The Mother Commander's throne and all symbols of her office had been removed. Soon, the meaning of that gesture would become apparent to all. On the walls and vaulted ceiling, she had ordered all frescoes and other ornamentation to be covered, leaving the huge chamber with a starkly utilitarian character, a signal that they needed to focus on bare necessities. Without explaining why, Odraid within reminded Mirbella of a Bene Gesserit axiom. All life is a series of seemingly insignificant tasks and decisions, culminating in the definition of an individual and her purpose in life. And she followed that with another. Each sister is part of the larger human organism, a life within a life. Remembering the stew of discontent that simmered among the factions, even here on Chapter House, Mirbella saw what Odraid was getting at. When our own sisters kill each other, more than just individuals die. At a recent supper, an altercation had left a Bene Gesserit dead and an honored Matre in a deep coma. Mirbella had decided to convert the comatose one into an axolotl tank to set an example, though even that was inadequate punishment for such continued, petty defiance. As she paced the speaking hall, the Mother Commander forced herself to recall the progress she had made over the past 4 years since their forced fusion. She herself had required years to make the fundamental change, to accept the core teachings of the sisterhood and see the flaws in honored Matre methods of violence and short-term goals. When Mirbella was young, the honored Matres had molded her into an adept who could control any male through sexual bonding. But she had herself been enslaved by the astonishing abilities of her supposed victim, Duncan Idaho, and held captive among the Bene Gesserit. Even as a prisoner, she had naively assumed her strength and abilities would prove to be greater than that of the witches. Such arrogance. At first, she had schemed to destroy the sisterhood from within, but the more Bene Gesserit knowledge and philosophy she received, the more she began to understand and frown upon her former organization. Mirbella was merely the first convert, the first hybrid of honored Matre and Bene Gesserit. On the morning of the gathering, the mixed representatives assumed their marked seats, dark green cushions arranged on the floor in ever-expanding concentric circles, like the petals of a blossoming flower. The Mother Commander placed her own cushion down among the sisters, rather than looming over them from a high throne. Mirbella wore a simple black single suit that gave her perfect freedom of movement, but without the flashy ornamentation, cape, or bright colors the honored Matres preferred. She also eschewed the concealing robes the Bene Gesserits usually draped over themselves. As the representatives situated themselves in a clash of mismatched clothes and colors, Mirbella decided abruptly that she would impose a dress code. She should have done so a year ago, after the bloody schoolyard brawl had left several acolytes dead. Even after 4 years, these women still clung to their old identities. No more armbands. No more gaudy colors or capes. No more flowing raven-like robes. From now on, a simple black single suit would do for everyone. both sides would have to accept changes. Not compromise, but synthesis. Compromises only drove both ends of the curve to an unacceptable and weaker average. Instead, both sides must take the best from the other and discard the rest. Sensing their palpable uneasiness, Mirbella rose to her knees and stared the women down. She had already heard of more former honored Matres slipping away to join the outcasts in the northern regions. Other rumors, no longer so absurd, suggested that some had even joined the largest group of rebels led by Matre Superior Helica on Tlilox. In light of what they had all just learned about the enemy, such distractions could not be tolerated any longer. She knew that many of the gathered sisters would automatically argue against the changes Mirbella planned to impose. They already resented her for the turmoil she had caused in the past. For a chilling moment, she compared herself to Julius Caesar standing before the Senate to propose monumental reforms that would have benefited the Roman Empire. And the senators had voted with their daggers. Before speaking, Mirbella performed a Bene Gesserit breathing exercise to calm herself. She became conscious of a change in the air currents around her, something intangible. Narrowing her eyes, she took note of details, of the placement of seated and standing women. After activating the receiving hall's sound system with a wave of her hand, Mirbella spoke into a microphone that dropped on a suspensor and hovered in front of her face. "I am unlike any leader the Sisterhood or the Honored Matres have ever had. It is not my purpose to please everyone, but instead to forge an army that has a chance, however slight, of survival. Our survival. We cannot afford the time for gradual changes." "Can we afford changes at all?" grumbled one Honored Matre. "I cannot see how they have benefited us." "That is because you cannot see. Will you open your eyes or congratulate yourself on your blindness?" The other woman's eyes flashed, though the orange flecks had long ago gone away from the lack of orange spice substitute. Just behind her, a Bene Gesserit sister arrived late. She approached along a narrow aisle, scanning the area around her as if searching for her seat. But every woman knew her assigned place. The latecomer should not be going in that direction. Watching with peripheral vision as she spoke, Mirbella gave no sign that she had noticed anything amiss. The dark-haired and high-cheekboned woman looked unfamiliar. "Not someone I know." She kept her gaze forward, internally counting the seconds as she mentally mapped the newcomer's approach. Then, without looking back, using the full reflexes wired into her from both Honored Matre and Bene Gesserit training, Mirbella sprang to her feet. With breathtaking speed, she spun in the air to face the woman. Before her feet could touch the floor again, the mother commander bent backward, just as the attacker moved in a blur, pulling something from the pocket of her robe and slashing out in a single fluid motion. Milky white and crystalline sharp, an ancient kris knife. Mirbella's muscular responses bypassed conscious thought. She dipped with one flattened hand, avoiding the tip of the plunging kris knife, and drove upward to strike the wrist. A thin bone popped with a sound like dry wood breaking. The would-be assassin's fingers opened and the kris knife began to fall, but so slowly it seemed to hang suspended, like a feather. When the woman raised her other arm to fend off a second blow, Mirbella hit her with a smashing punch to the throat, crushing her larynx before she could cry out. As Mirbella's adversary collapsed, the kris knife clattered to the floor, its blade shattering. A dim part of Mirbella's mind was pleased to see both sisters and honored Matres leap from their cushions, instinctively jumping up to aid the mother commander in case the coup attempt was more widespread. In their motions, she recognized truth, just as she had seen the lies in the motions of the would-be assassin. Both fat Belanda and wiry Doria pounced on the fallen woman, holding her down. Now those two worked together. Still on her feet, Mirbella scanned the large room and cataloged the faces, assuring herself that there were no interlopers present and no threats. Though the lone attacker thrashed, trying to breathe, or maybe forcing herself to die, Belanda pressed the woman's throat, opening her air passage to keep her alive. Doria roared for a Sook doctor. The broken kris knife lay on the floor by the writhing woman. Mirbella assessed it with a glance and understood. Traditional weapon. Ancient ways. The symbolism of the gesture was clear. Mirbella used voice, hoping the injured woman was too weak to use standard defenses against the command. "Who are you? Speak!" With cracked and broken words rattling through her damaged throat, the woman forced out her answer. She seemed glad to do so and wildly defiant. "I am your future. Others like me will emerge from shadows, drop from ceilings, come at you out of thin air. One of us will get you. Why do you wish to kill me?" The other Bene Gesserits in the audience had fallen into an utter hush, straining to hear the attacker's words. "Because of what you did to the sisterhood." The woman managed to turn her head toward Doria as a symbol of the honored Matres. If she'd had the strength, she might have spat. "As Mother Commander, you raise the alarm about an outside enemy, while you welcome real enemies into our midst. Fool." Scowling grimly, Belanda provided the attacker's name after ransacking her mentat mind. "She is Sister Osafa Schramm, one of the orchard workers, a new arrival from across the planet. A Bene Gesserit has tried to kill me." No longer was it just the power-hungry honored Matres who sought to seize her position of power. "Shiana was right to flee and leave the rest of us to rot here." Looking up at the sisters, then giving a final glare at Mirbella, Osafa Schramm summoned the necessary courage and willed herself to die. As the assassin began her final spasms, Mirbella shouted, "Belanda, share with her. We must discover what she knows. How widespread is this conspiracy?" The Reverend Mother reacted with unexpected speed and grace, slapping her hands to the woman's temples and pressing their foreheads together. "She resists me, even with her dying breath, not letting her thoughts flow." Belanda winced, then withdrew. "She's gone." Doria leaned closer and grimaced. "Smell that. Share, and lots of it. She's made sure we can't even use a mechanical probe to pry loose her thoughts." The gathered sisters murmured uneasily. Mirbella wondered if she needed to subject everyone to truthsayer interrogation. 1,000 of them. And if this Bene Gesserit sister had tried to kill the mother commander, could Mirbella trust even her truthsayers? Marshaling her concentration, she gave a dismissive wave toward the dead woman on the floor. "Remove that. Everyone else, resume your seats. A gathering is serious business, and we have fallen behind schedule." "We're with you, Mother Commander," a young woman shouted from the audience. Mirbella couldn't tell who said it. Doria quietly returned to her seat, watching Mirbella with grudging respect. Some of the former honored Matres in the audience were clearly surprised. Some smug, others indignant that a knife blade could have come from the coldly pacifistic Bene Gesserits. Mirbella gave no more than an annoyed glance as women hustled away with the bundled body of the dead woman. I have fended off assassination attempts before. We have important work to do here, and we must quash these petty rebellions among us, erasing all vestiges of our past conflicts. For that, we would need collective amnesia, Belanda snorted. A thin wave of laughter spread through the room and dissipated quickly. I will force it upon you, Mirbella said with a glare. No matter how many heads I have to knock together. The fabric of the universe is connected by threads of thought and tangled alliances. Others may glimpse parts of the pattern, but only we can decipher all of it. We can use that information to form a deadly net in which to trap our enemies. Crone, secret message to the Face Dancer Myriad. An insistent communication seized Crone through the tachyon net as the guild ship departed Tlilox, where he had secretly inspected the progress of the new Gola in its axolotl tank. His lackey Uxtal had indeed implanted an embryo made from the cells hidden in the burned body of the Tliloxu master. So, the lost Tliloxu was not completely incompetent. The mysterious child was growing even now. And if the Gola's identity was as Crone suspected, the possibilities were interesting indeed. A year ago, Crone had deposited Uxtal in Bandalong with strict orders, and the terrified researcher had obeyed in every way. A Face Dancer replica might have been adequate to the task, given a clear enough mental imprinting of Uxtal's knowledge, but the squirming assistant had been performing with an edge of desperation that no Face Dancer could match. The predictable instinct of humans to survive. It could easily be used against them. As the guild ship drifted around the night side of Tlilox, the ship's viewers showed black scars where cities had been erased. Only a few weakly shining lights marked struggling towns that clung to life. Somewhere down there, the greatest works of the Tliloxu had their origins, even the primitive versions of Face Dancers, so many millennia ago. But those shape-shifting mules were little more than hand-daubed cave paintings compared to the masterpieces that Crone and his fellows had become. Face Dancers had taken over the crew positions on this ship, killing and replacing a handful of guildsmen, leaving only the oblivious navigator in his tank. Crone was not certain whether a Face Dancer could imprint and replace a grandly mutated navigator. That was an experiment to be considered at some later date. In the meantime, no one would know that he had come to Tlilox just to observe. No one, except for his distant supposed controllers who watched the Face Dancers at all times. Now, as Crone walked down the corridor of the cruising ship, his step faltered. The burnished metal walls blurred and became less distinct. His whole view tilted at an angle, then sideways. Abruptly, the reality of the guild ship vanished, leaving him standing in an empty, cold void, with no surface visible beneath his feet. Sparkling, colorful lines of the tachyon net writhed around him, connections extending everywhere, woven through the universe. Crone froze, his eyes widening as he looked around. He stopped himself from speaking. In front of him, he discerned a crystal-sharp image of the forms that the two entities chose for him to see. A calm and friendly-looking old couple. But they were anything but gentle and harmless. The two had bright eyes, white hair, and wrinkled skin that radiated a warm glow of health. Both wore comfortable clothes. The old man, a red plaid shirt, the matronly woman, gray gardening overalls. But though she had assumed the shape of a woman's body, she had not the slightest air of femininity. In the vision that trapped Crone, the two stood among fruit trees bursting with blossoms, so laden with white petals and buzzing bees that Crone could smell the perfume and hear the sounds. He didn't understand why this bizarre pair insisted on such a facade, certainly not for his benefit. He did not at all care about their appearance, nor was he impressed. Despite his grandfatherly face, the old man's words were harsh. "We grow impatient with you. The no-ship got away from us when it vanished from Chapter House. We caught another glimpse of it a year ago, but the craft slipped away from us again. We continue our own search, but you told us your face dancers would find it." "We will find it." Crone could no longer feel the guild ship around him. The air smelled like sweet blossoms. "The fugitives cannot evade us forever. You will have them, I assure you. We do not have that long to wait. The time is nearly upon us after all these millennia." "Now, now, Daniel," the old woman chided. "You have always been so goal-oriented. What have you learned in pursuing the no-ship? Hasn't the journey itself provided many rewards?" The old man scowled at her. "That is beside the point. I have always worried about the unreliability of your distracting pets. Sometimes they feel the need to become martyrs. Don't they, my martyr?" He said the name with dripping sarcasm. The old woman chuckled as if he had merely been teasing her. "You know I prefer Marty to Martyr. It's a more human name, more personal." She turned toward the blossom-laden fruit trees behind her, reached up with a tough brown hand, and plucked a perfectly round portigal. The rest of the blossoms disappeared, and now the trees were full of fruit, all of it ripe for the picking. Lost in this strange, illusory place, Crone stood boiling inside. He resented that his alleged masters could come upon him so unexpectedly, wherever he might be. The Face Dancer Myriad was a widely extended network. The shapeshifters were everywhere, and they would catch the no-ship quarry. Crone himself wanted control of the lost vessel and its valuable passengers as much as the old man and woman did. He had his own agenda, which these two never guessed. The Gola being grown on Tleelox could be an important component of his secret plan. The old man adjusted a straw hat on his head and leaned closer to Crone, though his image came from impossibly far away. "Our detailed projections have provided us with the answer we need. There is no possibility for error. Kralizek will soon be upon us, and our victory requires the Kwisatz Haderach, the superhuman bred by the Bene Gesserit. According to the predictions, the no-ship is the key. He is, or will be, aboard." Isn't it amazing that mere humans reached the same conclusion thousands of years ago with their prophecies and their writings? The old woman sat on a bench and began to peel the portigal. Sweet juice dripped from her fingers. Unimpressed, the old man waved a calloused hand. "They laid down so many millions of prophecies, they couldn't possibly have been wrong all the time. We know that once we acquire the no-ship, we acquire the Kwisatz Haderach. That has been proven." "Predicted, Daniel. not proven. The woman offered him a section of the orange, but the old man declined. When there is no doubt, then a thing is proven. I have no doubt. Crone did not need to pretend confidence. My face dancers will find the no-ship. We have faith in your abilities, dear Crone, the old woman said. But it has been nearly 5 years, and we need more than mere assurances. She smiled sweetly, as if she meant to reach out and pat him on the cheek. Don't forget your obligations. Suddenly, the multicolored lines of force around Crone grew incandescent. Through all the nerves of his body, penetrating every bone and muscle fiber, he felt a searing agony, an indescribable pain that went beyond his cells and beyond his mind. With his intrinsic face dancer control, he tried to shut down all of his receptors, but he could not escape. The agony continued, yet the old woman's voice remained exceptionally clear in the back of his thoughts. We can keep this up for 10 million years if we choose. Abruptly, the pain was gone, and the old man reached over to take half of the peeled fruit the woman offered him. Tearing off a section, he said, "Do not give us an excuse to do it." Then the illusory world wavered. The bucolic orchard disappeared, and the bright network of lines faded, leaving only the metal-walled corridors of the guild ship again. Crone had collapsed to the deck, and no one else was around. Shaking, he climbed to his feet. The throbbing agony still burst out in cellular echoes from dark afterimages behind his eyes. He drew several breaths to regain his strength, using his outrage as a crutch. During the wash of pain, his features had shifted through numerous assumed guises and reverted to their blank face dancer appearance again. Gathering himself, Crone vengefully formed his face into an exact replica of the old man's. But that was not enough for him. Feeling petty rage, he drew back his lips to expose teeth that he transformed into brown and rotted stumps. Crone's imitation of the old man's wrinkled face became rotted. Flesh hung in sagging folds, then turned yellow before separating from the muscles. Vindictively leprous blotches covered the skin, and the face became a mass of boils, the eyes milky and blind. If only he could project the condition. It was what the old bastard deserved. Crone reasserted himself again, restoring his normal appearance, though the anger remained unquenched within him. Then his smile gradually returned. Those who considered themselves the rulers of the face dancers had been fooled again, just like the original Tliloxu masters and their offshoots, the Lost Ones. Still shaking, Crone chuckled now as he walked along the guild ship's corridor, regathering his strength. He looked like an average crewman again. No one could possibly understand the fine art of deception better than he did. I am its greatest practitioner, he thought. Damn your analyses and your infernal projections. Damn your legal arguments, your manipulations, your subtle and not so subtle pressures. Talk, talk, talk. It all comes down to the same thing. When a difficult decision must be reached, the real choice is obvious. Duncan, Idaho, 9th New Gola, shortly before his death. In the bright chamber that served the Jews as their temple, in a ceremony as traditional as the no-ship's stores could provide, the old rabbi led the Seder. Rebecca watched with an unexpected new understanding of the root meanings behind the ancient ritual. She had lived it herself in her memories ages ago. Though he would never admit it, even the rabbi did not grasp some of the nuances, despite a lifetime of study. Rebecca would not correct him, however. Not in front of the others, not even in private. He was not a man who wished for a refinement of his understanding, not as a souk doctor, nor as a rabbi. Here, isolated from many of the strict requirements of the ancient Passover service, the rabbi followed the rule of the Seder as best he could. His people acknowledged the difficulties, accepted the truth in their hearts, and convinced themselves that everything was correct and proper, lacking in no detail. God will understand, so long as we do not forget, the rabbi said in a low voice, as if uttering a secret. We have had to make do before. For the private observance in the rabbi's extended quarters, which also served as their temple, they had matzahs, maror, or bitter herbs, and something resembling the right kind of wine. But no lamb. A processed meat substitute from the ship's stores was the closest he could come. His followers did not complain. Rebecca had celebrated the Passover all her life, participating without questioning. Now, however, thanks to those millions from Lampadas in her head, she could delve through countless paths of memory across a wide web of generations. Buried within her were recollections of the first true Passover, lives as slaves in an incredibly ancient civilization called Egypt. She knew the truth, understood which parts were the strictest historical fact and which had slowly strayed into ritual and myth, despite the best efforts of rabbis to keep faith with previous generations. Perhaps we should smear blood over the lintel on our quarters, she said quietly. The angel of death is different from before, but it is death nevertheless. We are still being pursued. If we can believe what Duncan Idaho says. The rabbi did not know how to respond to her often provocative comments. He protected himself by retreating into the formal order of the Seder. Jacob and Levi helped him with the blessing on wine, the washing of hands. They all prayed again and read from the Haggadah. These days, the rabbi frequently grew angry with Rebecca, snapping at her, challenging her every statement because he saw the work of the devil within it. If he had been a different sort of man, Rebecca could have talked with him for hours, describing her memories of Egypt and Pharaoh, the awful plague, the epical flight into the desert. She could have recounted real conversations to him in the original tongue, shared her impressions of the living man Moses. One of her myriad ancestors had actually heard the great man speak. If only the rabbi were a different sort of person. His flock was small. Not many of them had gotten away from the honored matres on Gamu. For millennia upon millennia, their people had been persecuted, driven from one hiding place to another. Now, as they let themselves be swept up in the festive Passover ritual, their voices were few though strong. The rabbi would not allow himself to admit defeat. He doggedly did what he believed he must do, and he saw Rebecca as a foil against whom to test his mettle. She did not ask for his censure or suggest a debate. With all the memories and lives within her, Rebecca could easily counter any erroneous statement he might make, but she had no wish to make him look like a fool, did not want him to grow even more resentful and defensive. Rebecca had not yet told him of her recent decision to take on a greater responsibility, an even greater pain. The Bene Gesserits had called, and she had responded. She already knew what the rabbi would say about it, but she had no intention of changing her mind. She could be as stubborn as the rabbi if she so chose. The horizon of her thoughts extended to the edge of history, while his thoughts were bounded by his own life. By the grace spoken after their meals, then the happy Hallel and the songs, she discovered that her cheeks were wet with tears. Jacob saw this with a hushed awe. The service was moving, and with her perspective it seemed more meaningful than ever. Her weeping, though, came from the knowledge that she would not see another Seder. Much later, after the benediction and the last reading, when the small party had finished eating and departed, Rebecca remained behind in the rabbi's quarters. She helped the old man put away the paraphernalia of the service. The awkward distance between them told her that he knew something was troubling her. The rabbi held his silence, and Rebecca didn't offer to speak. She could sense him looking at her with his flashing eyes. Another Passover service aboard this no-ship. Four so far, he finally said, falsely conversational. Is this any better than being hidden like rodents under the ground while honored Matre searchers try to uncover us? When the old man was uncomfortable, Rebecca knew he resorted to complaints. How quickly you have forgotten our months of terror cramped in that hidden chamber, with our air systems failing, the waste recycling tanks over full, the food supplies dwindling, she reminded him. Jacob couldn't fix it. We would all have died soon, or been forced to slip away. Maybe we could have eluded the terrible women. His words were automatic, and Rebecca could tell he didn't believe them himself. I think not. Overhead in the ash pit, the honored Matre hunters were using their scanning devices, probing the soil, digging for us. They were close. They suspected. You know it was only a matter of time before they discovered our hiding place. Our enemies always find our hiding places. Not all of them. We were lucky the Bene Gesserit chose to attack Gamu when they did. It was our chance, and we took it. The Bene Gesserit. Daughter, you always defend them. They saved us. Because they were obligated to. And that obligation has now made us lose you. You are forever tainted, girl. All those memories you took within your mind corrupted you. If only you could forget them. He hung his head in a melodramatic gesture of misery, rubbing his temples. I shall forever feel guilt because of what I made you do. I did it willingly, Rabbi. Do not go looking for guilt that you did not earn. Yes, all those memories wrought great changes in me. Even I did not guess the magnitude of that weight from the past. They rescued us. But now we are lost again, wandering and wandering on this ship. What is to become of us? We have begun to have children, but what good does it do? Two babies so far. When will we find a new home? This is like our people's sojourn in the desert, Rabbi. Rebecca actually remembered parts of it. Perhaps God will lead us to the land of milk and honey. And perhaps we will vanish forever. Rebecca had little patience for his constant moaning, his wringing of hands. It had been easier to tolerate the old man before, to give him the benefit of the doubt and let her faith counsel her. She had respected the rabbi, believed everything he said, never thought to question. She longed for that innocence and confidence again, but it was gone. The Lampadas horde had made sure of that. Rebecca's thoughts were now clearer, her decision irrevocable. My sisters have asked for volunteers. They have a need. A need? The rabbi raised his bushy eyebrows, pushed his spectacles back up. The volunteers will submit to a certain process. They will become axolotl tanks, receptacles to bear the children they have determined are necessary for our survival. The rabbi looked angry and revolted. It is clearly the work of evil. Is it evil if it saves all of us? Yes, no matter what excuses the witches give. I do not agree, Rabbi. I believe it is the work of God. If we are given tools for our survival, then God must want us to survive. But the evil inclination tricks us by sowing seeds of fear and suspicion. As she had expected, he bridled. His nostrils flared and he grew indignant. Do you suggest that I am following an evil inclination? Her counterblow was strong enough to knock him off his feet. I'm saying that I have decided to volunteer. I will become one of their womb tanks. My body will provide a necessary receptacle so the Golas can be born. A softer voice now, kinder words. I trust you will look upon those children I bear and give them whatever aid and counsel they might require. Teach them if you can. The rabbi was aghast. You cannot do this, daughter. I forbid it. It is Passover, Rabbi. Remember the blood of the lamb on the doorpost. That was allowed only during the days of the Solomonic Temple in Jerusalem. It is forbidden to do it anywhere else at any time. Nevertheless, though I am far, far from untainted, this may be enough. She remained calm, but the rabbi was shaking.